It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. 2 weeks ago, I spoke with Jane Chu, the chairman for the National Endowment for the Arts, when she was in Iowa. And when we were talking about the state of the arts in Iowa, she said something kind of surprising. She said that Iowa has a strong jazz scene and that she was surprised by the high number of live jazz events Iowans attend compared to people in other states. And that made us want to find out what's going on in jazz in Iowa. So this hour, we'll explore jazz in Iowa, past, present, and future. And of course, you're welcome to join our conversation as well. We're going to start the hour with John Rapson. He's a professor of music at the University of Iowa. He's also a composer, trombonist, and pianist. He used to host a jazz show on public radio, no less. Hello, John.
Hi, Charity.
Thank you so much for being here today.
It's a pleasure.
We also have Bob Washit with us, professor of music at the University of Northern Iowa, where he served as director of jazz studies from 1980 through 2002. He's also a composer and arranger. Hello, Bob.
Hi, dear Charity. Nice to be here.
Yeah,
hey,
thank
Bobby.
You so
Hi,
much
John.
For being here today. So I want to go back. I know that there's a strong tradition, particularly at the University of Northern Iowa with jazz, but I want to go back earlier than that. We know that jazz was born around the turn of the 20th century in New Orleans. What do we know about when jazz first started being performed in Iowa?
Well, I don't know a whole lot about the early years, but I know that there was a tradition of these territory bands that were kind of spearheaded in the Kansas City, Oklahoma City area. Mm. And that found its way up north to Iowa. And I know our former dean of the College of Humanities and Arts here at UNI, Tommy Thompson, played Barry in some of those territory bands way back then. And then, of course, we have this a whole bunch of famous dance halls, you know, in the state. Electric Ballroom here in Waterloo would be an example. They provided venues for a lot of traveling bands, including some of the big-name bands.
And I'll throw in here that my grandfather was the leader of one of those territory bands in the state of Iowa in the 30s and 40s, and they traveled the whole Midwestern region playing in Iowa and
right.
Kansas, Nebraska, et cetera. And
Panhandle of Texas out to Oklahoma. They did little cloverleaf tours out of Kansas City and would make a run into one region and then come back and get fortified, I guess.
Now, even before that, though, we had Bix Beiderbecke from the state of Iowa, very, very famous cornetist and very influential in music in the 20s.
Well, and I'm not sure what we know about that that might be apocryphal versus real historical fact. Certainly, certainly the riverboats did come up from New Orleans up the Mississippi, and who would have played or docked there is anybody's guess, but certainly there were lots of bands. And I also want to say that recent scholarship has shown that it's a lot harder to tell how the spawning of the music happened, because we have Kid Ory in Los Angeles as early as 1916, and we have so much music. Johnny Dunn, for instance, is in Memphis in the early teens as well. So music certainly does come up the river from New Orleans, but that's kind of a good story. It was really more complicated than that, and the musicians were going wherever there was work, and the circuits had already been developed through minstrel shows and so on. So they were following those same circuits to get work itself.
And were these early musicians self-taught? Was there any kind of musical education they could turn to?
Well, Bob, can I handle that?
Sure.
Yes and no. It's really complicated. It's really messy because in the late 19th century, you had a number of artists that were ragtime artists, but that was written music, and they were university trained, many of them. And you also had a number of Creole musicians who were playing in theater bands and in dance orchestras and so on, and they all knew how to read. But with Plessy versus Ferguson, when we had the separate but equal laws that came after the Civil War, what happened was that these educated musicians were thrown together with a number of musicians that were also self-taught from blues traditions, from gospel traditions. There are so many different musics and marching music, right? We know that the brass bands that came out of New Orleans were originally from military bands. So the mix is very difficult to develop into one strain, and they include musicians who wrote music and were trained, as well as musicians that were self-taught.
Well, I think it's interesting to look at the first 30, 40 years of jazz. There were so many different styles that were being played during that time. We think, of course, about Dixieland jazz, which is one of the first genres. But as it developed, it changed so much.
Well, it came from a myriad of styles. Like I said, we can trace it to march music and to ragtime. Sidney Bechet said that he referred to it as ragging a tune from the very beginning. He never called it jazz. He didn't like that word. And thought of himself as taking tunes that he had learned from other repertoires and then improvising over the tops of them. So there were already a lot of styles that were in the fabric, blues and ragtime and march music and all the schottisches and polkas and dance music that was part of society orchestras in the late 19th century. And it gets combined in a variety of ways. And the era that you were talking about of the late 20s and the 30s, where the territory bands develop, are starting to see a codification of both some of the ensembles and the instrumentation and an approach to swing that was not necessarily evident in all of the musics that were part of the progenitors.
Now, jazz was incredibly popular as far as dance music went. Was it considered to be subversive? Were people suspicious of jazz?
Well, I think early on there's a lot of negative attitude about jazz, that it was the devil's music and it created all these social problems and things like this. But with the advent of the swing era, we see jazz kind of cleaned up, made palatable for white audiences. Mm-hmm. And
so was this an issue of race, do you think, in the early years?
Oh, without question.
There's all kinds of racial stereotypes. One of the early ragtime orchestras was James Reese Europe. And he worked with a dance troupe, Vernon and Irene, I'm just blanking on the last name.
Castle. Yeah.
Yeah, thanks. They wanted to make a lady out of jazz. They wanted to make it palatable to white middle-class people. And so they had a black orchestra, but then a white dance couple. And they're the ones that, you know, like the Arthur Murray Studio, made it palatable to a much larger audience. The other stereotypes nonetheless persisted. And there's a big distinction, for instance, in the 30s between the sweet bands and the hot bands. And if you're good moral citizen, you paid attention to sweet bands but not the hot bands.
What was the difference musically?
You want to jump in, Bob, or should I go?
Well, yeah, a lot of it was just spirit. The hot bands tend to be a lot more improvisation-driven, less complicated arrangements, more arrangements off the top of the head kind of thing. They called them head charts. And there was a really strong swing feel to most of that music, whereas the so-called king of swing, Paul Whiteman, was one of these guys, he said, who wanted to make jazz a lady.
Right.
And so it was all this sweet harmony and things that were more palatable to white culture.
So maybe the kinds of things that we'd later hear on the Lawrence Welk Show?
That would be a continuation.
Or Guy Lombardo, traditions maintained.
Exactly.
And they were definitely racial. I mean, largely black bands associated with the hot tradition and largely white bands associated with the sweet tradition.
Yes.
When did jazz education start to develop, John?
Okay. Well, Bob should really answer this, but as I understand it, the first college that started the program was North Texas State in, I believe, 1948. It was the very late 40s anyway. There's all kinds of facets that come into the creation of jazz. I think myself, one of my theories is that the children, the teenagers and servicemen of the 30s and the 40s were parents and administrators and teachers in the 50s and 60s. So they had a lot at stake in terms of introducing their music into American society. And they're coming back from a time when the Second World War took jazz all over the world. So the whole world, because of radio, knows about this music. And it coincides with the Cold War. We were really interested in using jazz as a propaganda tool, sending out people like Ella Fitzgerald and Duke Ellington and Louis Armstrong as ambassadors during the 50s. And it's the same time that we changed a lot of curriculum towards things American in our own curricula. And so a number of the land-grant colleges were the first to jump on the wagon to promote things American.
And, of course, University of Northern Iowa, not one of the land-grant schools, but one of the first schools in the country to embrace jazz. Bob, why is that?
Well, I have a theory. UNI is like one of the former teacher colleges, and in the status among the universities in the state, you know, it's the lowest rung on the ladder. And I think whereas the University of Iowa and Iowa State tended to be more research-oriented and more scholarly, you know, that was where the emphasis was.
So-called.
Yeah. That UNI found an opportunity to grab an identity by the embracing of jazz, which mm-hmm. had been largely rejected by the other two schools. And this is not atypical all over the place.
Right. Well, we're going to have to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. I'm talking with Bob Washer, professor of music at the University of Northern Iowa, where he served as director of jazz studies from 1980 through 2002, and John Rapson, professor of music at the University of Iowa. We'll continue our conversation about jazz in Iowa in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about jazz in Iowa, past, present, and future. With me right now, John Rapson, professor of music at the University of Iowa, Bob Washit, professor of music at the University of Northern Iowa, where he also served as director of jazz studies from 1980 through 2002. And Bob, just before the break, we were talking about how UNI really embraced jazz and jazz education. And even in the 1950s, the students put on an underground concert. Tell me about that.
Yeah, that was literally underground. They were not permitted to practice jazz in the halls of the music building. And so they went underground and found various places to rehearse, and they put on a very successful, basically a dance concert that featured a big band and some vocalists. And it was so successful that they did another one that same year, and then it became an annual tradition, the Symphonian Dimensions and Jazz show that would always bring in a guest artist. And then about 4 or 5 years later, the Tall Corn Jazz Festival, which is still going, became associated with the same weekend, and we started to bring high school jazz bands to UNI for a little festival.
So that first underground concert was a huge success. Was that the thing that really shook things loose in the music school at UNI?
I have to think so. I should note that a few years back, I think it was 2001, we celebrated the 50th anniversary of that first concert, and we had four alumni big bands from all the eras, and it was really, really an amazing event.
So tell me a little bit about the jazz culture at UNI, how it grew, because I know you've had really tremendous bands throughout the years. What makes this focus so successful there?
Well, like I say, it was the only game in town for a long time. And so early on, UNI was the place to go if you wanted to study jazz. That has since changed, obviously. People are going east a lot more now because, you know, New York is the the center of jazz.
Yeah, I've heard a few things about that.
Anyway, just that early impetus with I think, SDIJ and the Tallcorn Jazz Festival. And you and I had gone to Jim Coffin, former director, had taken the band to some festivals, one of which was in Washington, D.C., and gotten all kinds of acclaim. And so it kind of put jazz on the map at a national level. And then in 1976, you and I actually hired the first official director of jazz studies, my predecessor, Rick Lahn. You know, that long tradition, I think, is a big part of why you and I kind of got out of the gate pretty fast there.
You know, when we talk about jazz, it's such a big umbrella for so many different styles. Is there a particular style of jazz that's been the focus of education at UNI?
Well, I would like to think that what I've done and what my colleague Chris Mertz has done has been to try to embrace, all kinds of styles, very eclectic kind of thing, because jazz indeed is a big word now. And it has absorbed styles from all over the world. And so to keep it relevant, I think it's important to be able to cover all those styles possible. So if you were to attend a typical UNI jazz concert, you'd get a sampling of a lot of things, much like a nice five-course dinner.
Well, and we've been doing a lot of talking, and we haven't been playing a lot of music. I know both of you brought some music with you. And, Bob, I'd love to listen to a little bit from one of your picks. This is Fee Fi Fo Fum. Tell me about what we're going to hear.
Well, this is from a record Chris Mertz and I did about 6-7 years ago, a little duet record, piano and saxophone. And this is a Wayne Shorter tune called Fee Fi Fo Fum.
Just a little bit of Fee Fi Fo Fum, composed by Wayne Shorter, and of course featuring Bob Washit on the piano. Bob, for people who don't know about jazz, and we were talking about the jazz scene in Iowa today, do you have sort of an idea, a good entry jazz music idea for people who want to get into it?
Well, I think the classic suggestion is Miles Davis is Kind of Blue. That is such an accessible record because it's so lyrical. And it's the one record everybody says you should start with if you're trying to get into jazz. And I don't think you could really top that. I think in the 70s, you know, there was an attempt to try to marry jazz with rock. And so there was a lot of rock-influenced jazz that, again, I think brought a lot of people that were prior not interested in jazz, but then embraced it because there was something they could relate to.
We're going to bring Dave Resig into the conversation from the Des Moines Big Band in just a moment. But before we do that, John, I want to ask you, give me an idea of the scene at the University of Iowa these days as far as jazz goes.
Well, it's a lot to encapsulate as well. We try to cover the whole history of jazz with our large ensembles, but then we have individual students who develop projects in a variety of directions from that. We're now, I believe, in our 8th year of having a jazz master's, MA in jazz studies, and that program is built around a thesis project in which people, when the students write all of the music that is on the CD, and they have to demonstrate a connection between their improvisatory approach and the writing that they do. And that's spawned a lot of original music. And there are groups still locally like Coplant No and La Ranja and Groove Theory that are active. And we have other students that have left. One of our students went to Kansas City, and now he plays in a trad band that does a lot of early, very early jazz from the teens and the 20s. And there are many people who are interested in bebop and that central direction of either bebop or hard bop. And so there's a whole variety of things. And I'm as interested in the things that actually go out as emissaries from the University of Iowa as I am our very specific programming in the School of Music. It gives me a lot of pride and joy to hear these bands continue on their own.
Well, and just as we were going out of the last break, we played a little bit of bebop accordion, Art Van Damme's bebop accordion, and that's from Crescendo. Tell me about that.
Oh, that was a collaborative project we did last fall. We did work with Paul Kalina, who is a physical theater professor at the University of Iowa, and he introduced us to a mask maker from Italy, and we created a play, an improvised play with music, that 16 scenes from school. And so I wrote that music in advance, and I create a library basically for them to choose from. And then they develop routines that worked with each of those, well, about 25 of the pieces.
And let's play another selection from that CD. This is the Carla Bley Curtain Calls. Tell me... We'll listen. Carla Bley Curtain Calls. Tell me a little bit about this piece. This is also from Crescendo, the project we were just talking about.
Well, we literally did curtain calls, and later in the piece you'd hear quotes from different American patriotic songs, as Carla is wont to do. She is really a jazz composer who draws on the inheritance of Charles Ives. And it's some of it's tongue-in-cheek. We have some hip-hop in there that would come along with the clave patterns that we were using. All to say, this is kind of a good way to introduce all the actors at the very end of the show and come out for curtain calls. And so each of the pieces I wrote for the show were based on the model of a different composer who I thought I could use in a generic way that then we could fine-tune to the specific needs of the show.
Now, with jazz, there's a great deal of improvisation that goes on with jazz. As you work with performers getting ready for a concert or an event like the one we were just talking about, does the improvisation that they do during a piece, are they honing it? Is it similar every time? Or are you surprised by what happens with a piece that maybe that you've composed?
Well, it really depends on the player. You know, the idea of playing something that is different every time you improvise it is an inheritance out of Charlie Christian's tradition. And other people were more built around routines. And you listen to pop, you listen to Louis Armstrong, and often you'll hear him play very similar things. From cut to cut. All to say, yes, my players do surprise me. And since they're in school, a lot of our goals here are to give them tools to draw on. The analogy I like to use is how you teach somebody to play basketball. Well, yeah, you play the game and you teach them how to take 1,000 jump shots from the baseline and to do free throws and to do layups and how to run a weave and how to pick and roll and all these different individual things. But then some players tend to just go by the book, and then others, like Michael Jordan, just do things in the spur of the moment that draw on all of those skills that are unaccountable.
And Bob, do you want to chime in on that?
Well, yeah, I think, like John said, it depends a lot on the player, and certain people are more circumscribed by, you know, playing it safe, and other folks, just by sheer talent, I think, have a little more knack for really trying to explore, and so what they'll play from tune to tune will be, like, vastly different than somebody who just has a kind of one kind of dialect or one language.
Well, and Bob, back in the 90s, when I was in high school, I used to come to a lot of the concerts up at UNI. I'd go see the Jazz Band 1 and Jazz Band 2. Is there much of a performance scene in Cedar Falls?
Not really, but we make do. We have a couple venues where our combos play, and a venue where our big bands go out. And then there's a weekly thing at the local coffee shop. But the whole thing, I've been here so long, you know, I've just seen the ebb and flow. And there have been times when we had some things happening for a fairly sustained amount of time, and other times where all of a sudden it dries up and there's nothing. So I think John and Dave Rezik can talk about what's going on there. But I think things are turning around, especially in Des Moines.
Well, and that's a great time to bring Dave Rezik into the conversation, the Des Moines Big Band's band leader and trumpeter. Hello, Dave.
Hi, Charity.
Thank you so much for being here today.
Thanks for having me in.
Well, and the Des Moines Big Band has been around a long time. For people who aren't familiar with it, tell us a little bit about the history and performance of the Des Moines Big Band.
So, yeah, it's been around for a long time, nearly 60 years. I think 1959 was when it was founded, and it's gone through a lot of different iterations over the years. For the longest time was performing downtown at the Spaghetti Works location. And I think maybe 14, 15 years ago or so, they moved out to the Adventureland Inn, and were out there for a number of years. And then for the last 2 or 3 years, then we're out in Clive at El Palacio Cultural Center. So just kind of trying to find, you know, a home where we would get, you know, get the people back in. I came back to Des Moines about 8 years ago. And they were out at the Adventureland Inn location, and as far as getting people out there, it was kind of hit and miss. Sometimes the place was full, sometimes there were just a few, and it always just seemed. I remember the days when we used to go downtown and listen to the big band at Spaghetti Works when I was just a high school student at Hoover and in Des Moines here, and that place was packed and full of everybody, musicians, educators, parents, lots of kids. And that's kind of one of our first experiences, kids, of kind of, you know, really listening to the music and getting to know some of the players. And of course, everybody in the big band was so welcoming and wanting to share the music and wanting kids to participate. And, you know, some people got a chance to sit in once in a while. And that was a big inspiration. So I think, you know, one of the things we wanted to do is to try to find a way to kind of get back downtown if that opportunity ever came about, and that's kind of what's about to happen here.
And what is about to happen? Tell me about it.
Well, I've been working with a jazz singer here in town, Max Wellman, almost since I got back to Des Moines, and we've done a lot of different concerts and events together, and I've been his musical director for all those years and put some shows together, and he and I have talked a long time about, you know, what if somebody actually took the idea of opening up a jazz club and somebody with money supported that.
That's you, Dave?
Yeah, right.
that's what jazz musicians are known for,
I looked in my
right?
top drawer of my dresser, and I had a lot of change.
Under the mattress?
Yeah. That's right. No, so Bob and Maria Filippone stepped up and worked with Max to actually open up this club. And one of the first things Max talked to me about was bringing the Des Moines Big Band back downtown. So this new club, Noche, is going to open up on New Year's Eve, and and couldn't be more excited about it.
Very cool.
Well, very exciting. We're going to take a short break, and it's time for me to say goodbye to Bob Washit. Thank you so much for being here today.
My pleasure.
Bob Washit, professor of music at the University of Northern Iowa. He also served as director of jazz studies from 1980 through 2002. He's a jazz composer and arranger and pianist. John Rapson, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
John Rapson, professor of music at the University of Iowa, also a composer, trombonist, and pianist. We're going to take a short break. We'll continue our conversation about jazz in Iowa in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about jazz in Iowa, past, present, and future. We're going to talk about jazz education a little more in depth in just a moment. But right now, we're talking about the current jazz scene in Iowa, and we'd love to hear from you. Do you go out and see jazz on a regular basis? Who do you like to see? What have your influences been? How do you feel about the jazz scene in Iowa right now? 866-780-9100 is the number to call. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And Dave Rezig is here. He is the leader of the Des Moines Big Band and a trumpeter. And Dave, just before the break, we were talking about the new jazz club, Noche, that's going to open up in Des Moines. And they're always two sides to something like this opening up. The if you build it, people will come, hopefully, or, you know, if you ask for it, someone will build it. Do you feel like there's been more of a demand for jazz in the Des Moines area?
I do. And I think it's funny because I think there's always been a really good scene. You know, years ago when I had moved back here, I was actually surprised at how many great players were either still here or had recently moved back. Some of us are kind of boomerang jazz musicians where we kind of went out and went to school and or went to a jazz city and kind of got our chops together and did whatever we were going to do. And some came back to start families like myself. And it was just an explosive scene. However, there just weren't a lot of venue. There weren't a lot of playing opportunities. So one of the things I wanted to do is kind of get all the like minds together and kind of have us – you know, think about ways to get the music out there to for people to see it. And for a long time, I was a board member, original board member with Synergy Jazz Foundation, Bill Bergren's group. And that's one of the main things we wanted to do, aside from there's also a big education component to that and getting kids and also the jazz community together in support of the music. But one of the things I wanted to do is get a jazz series together. And I was able to get together with Zach Mannheimer and others at the Des Moines Social Club. And we went through three iterations of that, one in every venue they've had, one by the Sculpture Park and the other when they were in the Kirkwood and then again at the Firehouse. And I think it was that just that the fact that they had built that solid location or they had a permanent location at the Firehouse, that the financial support was there and we were, you know, fully ready to do it. And so our goal was to just bring, you know, 60, 70 people into this basement space and into the basement and do this jazz series. And my goal was to get, you know, all the top local musicians and then all the top musicians around the Midwest to perform at this space so that people in Des Moines actually could hear what was happening with jazz right now. A lot of people just have – they have whatever connotation they have of what jazz music is and whatever their experience may be. And I just don't think they were hearing what was happening. So that was one of our first main thrusts of today's jazz at people's ears, you know, was getting that jazz happy hour.
Well, and you said you wanted 60 or 70 people. How many people showed up?
Oh, we packed it. There were probably 200 plus. Wow. Standing room only. And the greatest thing about that was that when I looked around, I've been around a while. I kind of know the jazz community.
Right.
And I've seen people at Jazz in July and at various events. I hardly knew anybody in that room. A lot of people came in from downtown. We had people that just, admittedly, there was a Des Moines Social Club bump there. I think a lot of people were excited about anything the Des Moines Social Club was doing. And that's why I kind of knew there would be a good marriage there. And the great news is that has just held steady. So every single jazz happy hour has had, you know, say 100 to 200 people. And that's been a lot of fun. So what we wanted to do is build on that for Noche. You know, you had asked, you know, is it a matter of, you know, kind of the chicken or the egg thing? Is it playing the music and people will come, or is it finding a place where people will go and then you present that music? I think it's a little bit of both.
Well, speaking of music, let's hear a little bit of music. You brought a couple of songs with you, including a little bit of, this is Ridin' in the Basket from your Alpha State Agents. That's your septet.
Yeah. I should probably preface that. this is kind of an epic blues chart that I put together with my experience traveling from Missouri, moving out to Boston. I went to grad school out at New England Conservatory out there for my master's. And this tune goes on for about 19 minutes or so. It gives everyone a chance to kind of give their own version of the blues. And the story is about our cat that we had at the time, Noel, who we had literally had in a basket, you know, kind of on sedatives in the front of our U-Haul between my wife and I, and just what his perspective must have been in traveling there. And you'll hear an interesting quote as we get to the end of this clip, a Neil Diamond quote, and that's all reference to our arriving in Boston. There's a famous song that everyone sings at the seventh inning stretch at the Red Sox game, which is where that comes in play. And then the music that it goes out to was a very influential person for me, George Russell, and his Lydian chromatic concept, the person that was teaching out at New England Conservatory.
All right, a little bit of Ridin' in the Basket, a rough start there. But, you know, when a cat's in the car, I guess rough things can happen.
Yeah, exactly.
All right, I'm talking to Dave Rezik. He is the leader of the Des Moines Big Band. And I want to bring someone else into the conversation now. Susie Maget is co-founder of Creative Music Studio in Des Moines. She's also a musician herself. Hello, Susie.
Hello.
Thank you so much for being here today.
You bet. Hi, Dave.
Hey, Susie.
And I know the two of you work together quite a bit with jazz education. But Susie, let me ask you, in teaching students jazz, you know, when I think about kids starting out in band in fifth and sixth grade and learning to read the notes and playing whatever their band instructor puts before them, is there a different approach to teaching them jazz?
Well, in the broadest sense, I think that teaching music of any kind inevitably ends up to be an oral tradition, whether it's initially written or whether it's improvised. But I would say that teaching improvisation certainly has a different approach than written music, which is what most kids start out playing when they join band at school. A good way to think about it would be to say that if you play in concert band or play some solo classical repertoire, that's like giving a speech because all the notes are planned out, but you do interpret it. When you're improvising, it's like hanging out with your friends and having a conversation, and you don't really know where the conversation's going to go. And you have to have been speaking the language for several years in order to feel at ease with just, you know, speaking the language.
Right, because you're hanging out with friends and having fun, but you're on a stage in front of other people, and that's
right,
a pretty
exactly.
vulnerable thing to be.
Yes, we're using our instruments to express, you know, the conversation, and along with that, of course, it's less tangible than actual written language or spoken language. So, but yes, it's an entirely different approach, and you know, the school started. It's almost been 26 years now. And I had been teaching at Central College as the director of jazz studies and playing lots of gigs around town. And I'm also a writer and arranger. And a friend of mine who was a musical theater diva, we were saying, you know, we need to really look at something in the education world to kind of pass this along to with younger generations. And so we started the school. It's been going on forever. We have, I feel very proud of our, you know, the things that we've accomplished. In fact, many of the players who populate the Des Moines jazz scene now were initially students at Creative Music Studio, and that makes me feel good. We've also sent out many players out into the world. We've got a lot of players playing in New York and touring, lots of players on the West Coast as well, and it's a really totally satisfying in a different way than being a performing jazz artist, which is also fantastic. And it keeps the jazz scene really healthy to keep bringing up younger players and helping them develop and become the artists that they want to be.
What do you think draws students to you?
Well, I think initially it certainly would have been reputation as a player. And, of course, we've built a pretty good reputation for producing students who can really play. I mean, we don't water it down. We pretty much give them, you know, here's what you need to know to be a jazz player, and hopefully by the time you're finished with our program, you will be gig ready. You know, we've got several levels of jazz theory, several levels of improvisation. We've got performance combos, and we have instrumental techniques classes too, and all of those combined together to kind of see that big picture. And, you know, I mean, there's so much to it. We have things that involve actually developing your ear, and since the ideas have to come, you know, from your ear. And so I'm very happy about the pedagogy and the way the program has developed, and I love the kids. Each one of them is uniquely interesting, and it's an interesting process to kind of find out for this particular student what's going to bring out their voice as an artist. And it's not just young people. We have, I think our youngest student was a third grader. Actually, I've got a student who's in kindergarten now that is a singer-piano player. And then we have adults, too, you know, either people who played in high school or people who are local players who just want to increase their knowledge of the whole jazz picture. And we've had, you know, fathers and sons and fathers and daughters, and it's just been a really interesting time over the last 25 years. And in the past few years, we've added Dave Resick, of course, as our trumpet teacher, and Don Jaquis is handling saxophone. But we cover every instrument, so.
Well, and as a woman in jazz, of course, there have been a lot of amazing female musicians in jazz over the decades, but they kind of fit into certain niches over the years. There are some gender stereotypes in jazz, for sure.
That's very true. If you go back to the 40s and 50s, most of the famous women players were either a pianist
or
a singer.
Right, exactly.
And
so
that was kind of, you know, the powers that be thought that's what women should play. You know?
How about the students that come to you today? Is there a good gender balance?
I would like to see a better gender balance yet. It's still, it's probably two-thirds boys and one-third girls, and that has increased quite a bit. And you certainly see more women drummers, women bass players, women guitar players, you know, trombone, trumpet, saxophone. So that's helped a lot. And I do believe that there has been a change in the thinking. I'm not here to, you know, put down men in any way, but I do believe that there has been a social change in the way women are viewed and certainly encouraged from the male jazz teacher/player community. I think it's much more, we're much more on even ground now. And some of it was the young women themselves. They just never entered their mind that they could be a jazz trombone player. You know.
Well, before we run out of time, we've got John on the line from Le Grand. Hi, John. John, are you there?
Hi.
Hi. What would you like to talk about?
Well, I just wanted to mention that I started teaching band in the late 1960s, and I was a classical musician by training, and at that time the colleges would not allow any jazz at all in the music facilities at all, and the professors called it money-making music. And
well, in the immoral art. I've even heard it called the immoral art back in the day. Yeah, there was a bad attitude, wasn't there, for a long time?
Yes. And so in my first teaching job, why they used to call it a stage band because dance band wasn't appropriate, I guess, in these small communities. And so my very first job, within a month, we had to play at this venue in Marshalltown. And so I got the kids ready, and we played all of our eighth notes square, just like a classical, you know, just like Mozart. And we went out there, and as soon as we were done, it did a pretty nice job. As soon as we were done, why, Richard Francis, who is a jazz teacher in Marshalltown, since passed away, he was really an excellent teacher. He said, "John, go out and have some pizza." And he taught me. It was because of him I learned what swing was. It's a very interesting thing. And through the years, our band got better. And when I went to the middle school, we hired a student that I had. We won the jazz championships that year. So
you've come a long way. John, thank you so much for sharing your story. We're nearly out of time. But Dave, before we do run out of time, we talked about Noche opening up, so the Des Moines Big Band getting back downtown and some of the success you've had. How do you feel about the jazz scene in Iowa right now in 2015?
I'm really excited about it. I think the one, a couple things that we really needed, one was to better organize and just get our thoughts together as to how to push the music forward and get it. And then the other thing was to get it in front of people. So I think we've done a really good job with that. We've also been building, I've been trying to get all the Midwest cities to work together to, host each other. So we've got a connection with Omaha, Lincoln, Minneapolis, Chicago, Kansas City, and you know, there's a lot of back and forth happening right now.
So you're players. Bringing bands from there into
exactly.
Des Moines and vice versa.
Yep, and I think that's really bolstered what's happening here and also just brought to the forefront what's actually happening just in Des Moines and in Iowa City and Cedar Falls and Sioux City. I mean, Justin Kaiser's out in Sioux City. Just a lot of great players, and I think, you know, really just what needed to happen was to get more, you know, actual stages and bring people who apparently are very excited about the music together with what
now,
was happening.
There was a huge swing resurgence in the 1990s with popular music. We're not seeing something like that now. What do you think is driving new interest?
I think it's just that they, like as I kind of referred to, I think they just finally heard what was happening right now.
All right.
And I think there's a lot of excitement in the players and the level of musicianship kind of thanks to
Susie's school. I also think there's an older audience that still wants to hear true, real jazz, and that's what we're offering now in these clubs.
Mm-hmm.
So we're really trying to be true to the art form.
Well, thank you both so much for being here today. Dave Rezik is the leader of the Des Moines Big Band and a trumpeter. Susie Maget, co-founder of the Creative Music Studio in Des Moines. Thank you both.
Thanks,
Cherry. Thanks, Susie.
Yep.
Talk of Iowa is produced by Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe.